time for Yakety Science.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Yakety Science, the Tulsa Science Show. We are the program that shines a bright but humorous light into all of the darkest corners of the laboratory, the cuvette, and the cyclotron. We are the show that finds the surprise in your semnology, the hijinks in your hippology, the huh in your herpetology, the say what in your seismology, the kumquat in your quantum mechanical salad. I am Brian Cross, Associate Professor of Biology at Tulsa Community College and your humble host. Joining me, as always, the Watson to my Crick, is Associate Professor of Chemistry at Tulsa Community College. Say hello to the nice people, Matt.
Hello, and we should also give some justice to Rosalind Franklin. I forgot to make
Rosalind
that joke.
Franklin. Well, we don't have a third person here. We're flying
solo. We should add more people.
We should. Yeah, let's see. You want to stop and we can go find somebody on the street.
We just rope them in.
So, would you like to be Rosalind Franklin? What's been going on, Matt?
I had a horrific experience this week.
What was that?
Cooking. Oh, my gosh. So we were making chin saag, which is this Indian dish.
Was someone injured?
Yes.
Saag is the spinach. I know that.
Yes, it is indeed. Yeah, this is
it's
a spinach.
It's very slimy spinach, usually.
Chickpeas and peppers. Mm-hmm. And, oh, God, it was the pepper. I was chopping the serrano pepper.
Oh, did you wipe your eyes?
And, yeah, I did. Yeah. I'd washed my hands beforehand.
What was the Scoville rating on that pepper?
I don't know. Horrific is what it was. I washed my hands, and yet that was not enough. And so I had this hot pepper stuff in my eyes, around my skin, in my eyebrow, and I tried washing it off, and oh my gosh, it just made it worse. I did use my chemistry to best it, though.
Did you pour baking soda all over your eyes?
I did not. I used vegetable oil.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Because the capsaicin will not dissolve in water.
But it'll dissolve in oil.
It won't dissolve in soapy water even, but it will dissolve in oil. So, I rubbed my face with some vegetable oil, and then I used soapy water to get that oil off, and it took the capsaicin with it. So, that's the secret, listeners. If you get hot pepper juice in your eyes, you want to get it off or on your skin, vegetable oil. Oh. If it works with just anything that's just so gunky and like non-polar and hydrophobic that even soapy water won't do it, try oil.
Okay, excellent. That's a good idea.
There's a chemistry trick for you.
Well, I am, as always, master of the social media, so I've been trying to build our social media empire, and I became hip with my first Instagram reel.
That's pretty fancy.
Yeah, you saw it, didn't you, Matt?
You're modern.
Yeah, I am modern now. It actually was cross-posted to Threads as well, too, so we're on Threads.
We're on Threads, too?
Threads and
I don't think Instagram, I have a Threads.
Instagram reels. I don't know that I have Threads installed. maybe I had to install it in order for it to cross-post, I think. But there's that. We're not on TikTok, though.
And we're not on X.
The other thing to report from my social media activities is I had to come up with the art for our last, the pictures and the art for our last presentation. And so I kept trying to find pictures that we could use of the Pilbara Craton. And you would do these searches for Pilbara, and you would end up with just these things that look like the perfect craters, right? So it's like every article was accompanied by the sort of perfect crater that, it's like in the middle of a flat landscape, and it would go straight down, and there'd be a lake in the middle of it, or so on.
But are they still shaped like that? This is ancient.
Well, no, that's what I was saying. I kept thinking, well, what is going on here? Because, it's been obscured by erosion in 3.5 billion years. And I realized that all of these news outlets, because there's no good visual from Pilbara, they were just stealing crater pictures, other craters in Australia, other craters in other places that were like 100,000 years old or 200,000 years old. And so they still looked like craters and they still gave you this great visual. And you had to read the little tiny print underneath the photos in order to realize that it was not giving you a picture of the crater that all of the rest of the text was talking about.
That's so irritating.
It is so irritating and a little bit misleading. How many people are actually reading the caption on that? I think journalistic ethics are disappearing, right?
No, it's all about the clicks.
It's all about the clicks. And that's exactly it. It is driven by the clicks. They want people to scroll through a list of headlines and see that picture and say, oh, that looks cool, right? So they want a beautiful looking recent crater, but they end up misleading people about what the crater actually is. You will be happy to know that I did not use any of those misleading pictures in our art, which is why no one's clicked on our.
That's okay. You know what? Integrity is better than that.
How about we do some headlines?
Let's do it.
In this segment of the show, we trawl through, or perhaps troll through, the sciencey headlines that have struck our fancy since the last episode of Yakety Science. First up, we have developments in drunken monkey news. This relates to the drunken monkey hypothesis. This is the idea that fermented fruit that has a high alcohol content may have played some role in the evolution of our particular branch of the tree of life. So actual consumption of alcohol goes back quite far. This got some support about 10 years ago, and we discovered a gene mutation in the alcohol dehydrogenase 4 gene that allows the more effective metabolizing of alcohol, and that goes back 10 million years. So that is, you know, at the common ancestor of gorillas, chimpanzees, and human beings. So all of us, chimps, humans, gorillas, share this particular gene, which means that we can digest this alcohol, at least to some degree. The book of Genesis and evolution here are speaking with one voice to say that bad behavior in hominids goes back quite far, and it all can be found in bad fruit. So it all originates in bad fruit. But there's this framework for it. The recent development here is the analysis of what's called scrumping.
Scrumping.
That's right, scrumping.
All right, so what is scrumping?
Scrumping, as it's originally used, is just picking up fruit from the ground, I think. And so this is being applied to the behavior of chimpanzees, gorillas.
So can you demonstrate scrumping for me, perhaps?
Well, of course, Matt. Here's what it sounds like.
I feel like that's the sound we hear is just you nibbling and not exactly you foraging. So it needs to be like,
well, what is the sound of someone picking up fruit?
You need to show like they're rustling through the leaves and they're finding them. So they go out foraging for fruit that's fallen on the ground. And fruit that's fallen on the ground is more likely to be rotten and therefore also maybe fermenting.
This is just kind of filling in a bit of the picture here in this drunken monkey hypothesis. That hypothesis by no means is proven, but we're looking for evidence that bears upon it. And one of the gaps here has been, well, how much fermented fruit do they actually eat? Direct observations of them eating really rotten fruit has been minimal. And so they were looking for, okay, well, what's the kind of indirect way of ascertaining whether they're eating lots of fermented fruit? And they hit upon this idea of looking through all of the observation logs to see when were they picking up fruit off the ground. And so if they're scrumping this fruit, then it's more likely to be fruit that has fermented.
Now, this is for the terrestrial apes, such as us, such as gorillas, such as chimpanzees. Now, what about the, tree-dwelling apes? Is there a difference?
Right. Well, you know, so the gorillas and the chimpanzees are going to be kind of a mixture of arboreal and terrestrial. But then you have the orangutans, and the orangutans are apes that spend almost all of their time way up in the trees. And so they're not going to be exposed to as much of this. And they, in fact, do not have that mutation that allows them to consume, or at least to get energy out of and digest and process that alcohol, the ethanol. So they did this survey where they looked at populations of chimpanzees, of gorillas, and of orangutans, and then they looked at, okay, well, how much of the fruit is coming from scrumping? Okay, and they found that this was a significant portion of the fruit for chimps and gorillas, but not for orangutans. So,
there we go.
Yeah,
that's some good data there for maybe supporting the drunky monkey.
The drunky monkey, of course, the pedant in me. It just has to point out that none of the things we talked about there were monkeys. So it would be the drunken ape hypothesis.
Right? Oh, my gosh, you're right.
Yeah, so. But, you know, I mean, drunken monkey is what people say. They say the drunk monkey hypothesis.
It does roll off the tongue more. Yes. It's easier to say.
A couple of things that are left to be explored include how much of the fruit up in the trees is fermenting, you know, versus stuff that's on the ground. You could imagine this might vary depending on how fragile it is, right? How prone it is to fall when it's ripe. And then also, do we have a really complete survey? There was a quotation from Richard Wrangham, who was a very famous primatologist. He was saying that the chimpanzees that he studied, they don't do that behavior. They seem to be a bit more like the orangutans, at least the population that he's working with. So how truly widespread is it?
So maybe it's just a local group of drunken chimps.
Well, I mean, they had more than one local group. They did look across several different populations.
There's multiple frat houses out there.
Yeah, multiple frat houses. They were focusing on the fraternity row of chimpanzees. And Richard Wrangham has the honors dorm. Although I lived in the honors dorm, and they were employing their alcohol dehydrogenase quite a bit in the honors dorm.
The difference is they can pronounce it.
Yes.
So how do you feel about wasps?
I love them.
You do?
I do love them. They're fascinating creatures. For a brief period of time, I thought I was going to have a research career focused on the social behavior of wasps, ants.
That is not the response that most people would give.
It's true.
Ask me how I feel about wasps.
How do you feel about wasps?
I hate them. I think they're awful.
They're just wonderful creatures.
I think...
Fascinating creatures.
No. They are pollinators. That's the only cool thing they do.
The only thing that would make them more fascinating is if they have, like, radioactivity associated with them or somehow.
Oh, what a shock. Our next article is about radioactive wasps.
Excellent.
So this is at the Savannah River site, which is in South Carolina. It was a Cold War era facility that was making plutonium and tritium for atomic weaponry.
Hydrogen bombs.
Hydrogen bombs, indeed. And it's not in use. Hasn't been in use for a while. Apparently, some surveyors there found wasps who were radioactive.
Right.
Yeah. And they found not only one nest, but four nests that had radioactive wasps in them.
Yes. I assume there were balloons and jubilation as a result of this.
I mean, not from me. I would just be running away screaming.
Yeah, they said they sprayed them and bagged them.
Yeah, and they said not to worry.
Yes.
Yes, I am not worrying
everyone,
at all.
Everyone was very reassured by...
Right. They didn't really say
This problem is completely contained. No, we do not know how the wasp became radioactive. No, we do not know what the specific source of the radioactive contamination is. No, we don't know how many other wasps are contaminated. But
you have nothing to worry about.
You have nothing. We have this under control. And completely unrelated news. Did you hear about this new institute that's opening up close by? It's the Savannah River Avengers Institute. I think it was somebody named, who was the director? It was like Fury.
That's fantastic. You know, I read this article on The Onion about a child who was bit by a radioactive spider.
Oh, and he got superpowers.
He died of leukemia.
Oh, you're going to hell, Matt.
Absolutely. Right. I'm sorry. Look, dark humor is like food. Right. Not everybody gets it.
Man, he's doubling down. He's doubling down. All right. So if we hear anything new out of Savannah.
Everything's fine.
Everything is fine.
Everything's fine.
We've been assured, everything is fine.
Wasps don't typically travel far from their nests, so we're fine.
Any suggestion that things are not fine betrays your lack of loyalty to the United States government and to America. Matt is saluting. All right, do we have anything else on the wasps?
That's all I've got for wasps.
I mean, all joking aside,
a little bit scary.
You know, and we have some of these sites, like at Fukushima and Chernobyl, where you have kind of widespread contamination of plants and animals and all of the biota in a particular area from one of these accidents. It's obviously not encouraging to have that closer to home.
Indeed, it's not.
Up next, thanatosis has been newly documented in a neotropical frog species. It's been found in many other species, but newly documented in this frog species. This is the gold-striped frog, which is native to northeastern Colombia. Thanatosis is an excellent strategy for avoiding predators or unwanted mates or unwanted committee work. What is it, Matt?
Oh, it's playing dead.
It's playing dead. So if you are slumped over your desk when they come by to ask you to join the committee or to do the unpleasant task, then they'll just move on to the next person.
That's how it works. That's what I do.
He's dead. We've got to find
somebody. Got to find someone else.
Somebody else. Now, you may know the word thanatosis from the Greek god of death, Thanatos, mm-hmm. or from the character in the Avengers movies, Thanos, who gets really fed up with how crowded the world is and how many annoying people there are, and takes his begloved and bejeweled...
His bedazzled
fist and snaps his fingers, and then half the people in the universe disappear. So this is all related to death, and Thanatosis, as we said, is feigning death. In this particular species, again, the gold-striped frog, where it's been newly documented, it is presumably, as it is in most species, related to avoiding predation. So predators coming at you, You pretend that you are dead and thus unpalatable, right? Right. So for things that that are evolved to hunt other living things, if you pretend to be dead, then often that can deter the predation. It evidently works because it's evolved in several different kinds of organisms, most famously probably in the possum. We have the idea of playing possum. That is thanatosis.
I mean, that certainly tricked my dog, Nemo, a few years ago. He brought in a possum from the backyard and just slapped it on the ground and just like, yep, he was so proud of himself. And he just kind of just trotted off all proud-like. And then we looked at it, we're like, what on earth is it? And then it sat up in our bedroom. It was inside the house, and that was
scary.
I ended up grabbing it with these little long-handled grabby thing. So I grabbed one of those and chucked it outside.
Wow, Matt, how heartless of you.
What was I supposed to do with it? Make it a home?
Your dog mauled it and brought it into your house? I mean, the decent thing to do would have been to make it a little bed.
A little cup of coffee.
Until it recovered, a cup of tea. Mm-hmm. I know you guys don't do coffee, you do tea. So
that's true.
Make it a little cup of Earl Grey with a little drop of lemon and kind of nursed it back to health. Anyway, this is a common anti-predator adaptation, but there are other uses as well, too. And this particular article led me down the rabbit hole of other ways that this is used and led me to another article from a couple of years ago entitled Drop Dead Female Mate Avoidance in an Explosively Breeding Frog. There's lots of evocative words there. Drop dead.
Wait, explosively? That's what I picked up on.
Explosive breeding. Well, you know, you have some amphibian species that are going to breed in a way that's spread out more over the season. And then you have others that will have the breeding focused on, you know, one night or a couple of nights, a few nights. And so all of the business has to be taken care of all at once. So that's the explosive breeding. Nobody's breeding, then everybody's breeding, and then nobody's breeding. So there's an explosion of breeding.
One big crazy night of frog orgies.
I've actually had crazy frog orgies in the ponds outside my house.
I was waiting for you to finish that sentence.
There have been years when we've gone out there, and the American toad is one that is known for this kind of behavior, and just toads everywhere hopping around, and some of them mating. You know what frog mating looks like?
Oh, it's so the male like sits on the back of the female.
Right.
Because it's not like an internal fertilization sort of thing. It's external fertilization, isn't it?
It's not internal fertilization. The fertilization's happening outside of the body, but it's not like one deposits the eggs and then swims away and the other comes up and fertilizes the eggs. They are together when it happens. We call this amplexus. The male will get on the back of the female and with the little short stubby arms, we'll kind of squeeze the sides of the abdomen, stimulate the release of eggs by the female. As soon as the eggs are released, then the sperm is released by the male. Fertilization happens.
Wow, it's like working at bellows.
Kind of. But anyway, when you have these explosively breeding frogs, you have often this very intense competition between males to be in the prime spot on the female. And the male and female will be moving around, but there'll also be kind of all these other males that are kind of clustering around trying to knock that male off. And that you can get kind of these breeding scrums or balls. And you can actually get these situations where females are crushed within them, right? So this is a potential source of mortality. And so thanatosis has, in some of these species, been observed as a strategy for deterring an unwanted suitor. And so this article that I was reading is on a particular species, the European common frog, and they were documenting some of these mate choice behaviors. So they actually documented three different mate choice behaviors. One was kind of a rotation, kind of a rotate out of the embrace of the male, spin the male around so that it's sort of down in the water. The second was a kind of barking call to deter the male. And then the third was this thanatosis, which they observed in predominantly in the smaller females who are more likely to be crushed by too many males coming on all at once. They will just kind of extend their arms out. This is called tonic immobility. So the arms are just kind of extended out and they stop moving. And essentially, they're just kind of hanging out there. In one of these documented cases, they said that a female did this for 2 hours, played dead for 2 hours.
My goodness.
Until the male that was there gave up and went away.
If you drink yourself into a stupor, then you get gin and tonic immobility.
Yeah, that's the drunk monkeys.
The drunk monkeys. Now, bringing it back.
The drunk monkeys experience gin and tonic immobility. Yes, there you go. Matt, what's up next? I understand that there are developments with Uranus. Dare I ask you to say more?
Yes, of course, but what are you afraid of? NASA is just using the occult to study Uranus.
I thought we were talking about Uranus.
That's right, Uranus.
Now I'm confused, but go on.
No. Okay, so we say occult, but we mean an occultation, which is when one thing passes in front of another. It is occulted from view. In this case, Uranus occulted a distant star, and for that brief moment, the star's light shone around and through the atmosphere of Uranus, and NASA was able to collect some really interesting data about our beloved seventh planet.
Excellent. This is ringing a bell, Matt. I seem to remember something about this in relation to our Hycean fart gas planet.
That's right. Do you remember its designation?
It was B32X576.
That's right. 22. It was. It was K218B.
No, that's it.
Fantastic. Good
Close
job.
Enough.
I mean, yes and no. So that was an occultation, but during that occultation, they were using spectroscopy to measure the light that passed through the atmosphere and measure what types of bonds and molecules might be present in the atmosphere mm-hmm. of that distant planet. This occultation was a little bit different. They were just looking at the intensity of the light as the occultation took place. So...
And what are they hoping to learn from that? Are they able to learn something about the composition of the atmosphere from how it's blocking light?
They're trying to determine more about the density of the atmosphere in those different layers from the outermost, okay. you know, is going in towards it.
So the spectral lines will tell you about the different compounds that are present within the atmosphere.
Right, but that's not what they're doing here. Here, they're just looking at the intensity of the light okay, and so what shape the light is. So, you know, they're getting what they call a light curve, which is how quickly the intensity of the starlight wanes or waxes during the occultation. So at the beginning, you know, when there's, you know, you can see all the starlight from the distant star mm-hmm. and then Uranus starts to block it from view, well, depending on how quickly that light is extinguished, mm-hmm. will tell you something about the density, maybe the opacity, the translucency, right, mm-hmm. of the object of Uranus.
Okay.
We know what the composition of Uranus's atmosphere is. It's hydrogen and helium. Mm-hmm. But we don't have a good idea of exactly how dense it is and why the weather patterns are what they are.
So this is occultation of starlight with Uranus, but if you have occultation of Uranus, that's with your Levi's, right?
That's right, absolutely. Occultation is such a weird word.
It is a weird word. What is the difference between occultation and occlusion?
Right,
those
yeah.
are similar sounding words.
And I thought they were like supposed to be like the same word. That's uh-huh. why I did look it up. And yeah, so it, when you occlude something, it's more like blocking a hole. Mm-hmm. But when you occult something, it's when you're kind of blocking it.
You're drawing a veil over it.
You're drawing a veil over it. So there's a difference between an occultation and a transit in mm-hmm. astronomy. You know, when a smaller object passes in front of a larger object, like it doesn't block it off.
Like the transit of Venus across
Absolutely.
The sun.
Absolutely. Yeah. Or when you see the International Space Station pass in front of the sun.
Yeah.
That's a transit.
Okay.
But if the object was to block it off entirely, that would be an occultation.
Okay.
And,
or an eclipse.
And that's the next one. If the occultation results in you being cast in shadow, then it is an eclipse. So they're almost like three different degrees of the same sort of thing, something passing in front of the other. It's just how totally does it happen?
Wow. That's a complicated set of terms.
I know. Who makes up these things? I mean, it's good that we have these words.
I'll just say that the phrase NASA is using the occult to study Uranus is a phrase that casts a shadow.
I don't know. I think it's poetry. It's poetry in motion is what it is.
All right. Well, that's it for the headlines. Up next, we need to take care of last episode's Sound Science Puzzler. Here is again for your consideration. So, Matt, do you have any ideas about what this one was?
It's an eruption from Uranus.
I don't think so.
It's it is an eruption, though.
It is an eruption. Yeah, so this was the eruption of Mount St. Helens in 1980. certainly the eruption within the continental United States that created the most memories and that created the greatest impression among the American public, especially those who lived through it. I can remember my grandparents coming back from a trip to the West Coast and bringing back little vials of the ash from Mount St. Helens that they had on their mantle place and that we played with as kids. But that's what that was. That was the eruption of Mount St. Helens. Congratulations to those who got this one correct, and we'll have a brand new Sound Science Puzzle for you up later in the show.
Totally natural thing in it. It's totally natural thing in it. It's totally natural thing in it. It's...
Next up, we have Matt's Chemical Minute, a segment lasting 5 to 7 minutes. Matt is going to tell us about an element, a compound, or some other chemical entity that we should care about. He will then give this entity a rating of 1 to 5 stars. I will listen and then potentially argue with Matt about his rating. Today, Matt takes up the best known of all the tube gases of Las Vegas. That is neon, atomic number 10.
That is right, number 10, neon, which means new. Yeah, very new for number 10.
And so any of the elements could have been named neon.
Honestly, discovered. It's like, why did you choose this element of all elements to be called new?
I was reading about this. It was the suggestion of William Ramsey's son.
His son.
His son suggested that they call it novum, and then they translated novum into the Greek neon. So it came from his son.
So it did. All right. Well, thanks. Thanks, William Ramsey Jr. That sounds great. Look, everyone knows neon as the, you know, advertising signs, as neon lights and all that. And that is pretty much its only use and application. I mean, yeah, it's been used in like helium neon lasers and stuff, but most of it is just lighting. And it's not the only light. It's not the only, you know, tube gas we use for lighting things. We have other colors. Neon gives off that wonderful, beautiful red-orange color that you associate with neon lights. But there are other colors. Sometimes you get that just by using tinting on the tube. Sometimes you just use other gases, which give off different colors.
So you should say it's the only positive use of it. Of course, all the people that are addicted to neon huffing.
Is this actually a thing, or is this just a bit?
I'm just making up stuff.
I don't know. The fun story about neon is how it was isolated. So the only place to find neon is in the atmosphere. It's not a very big portion of the atmosphere, but that's the only place you can find it. You know, the air you're breathing is...
mostly nitrogen.
Mostly nitrogen.
Oxygen.
Oxygen, carbon dioxide, argon.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Argon. And down there at the very bottom of the list, towards the bottom of the list, is neon. It's like 0.002% of the atmosphere.
And this is because it is... not reacting with anything, and it's very light, and so that...
Absolutely right. So it doesn't stick around. It's too light, so it's just going to flit off into space, and it doesn't bond with anything at all because it's noble gas. It doesn't really do much at room temperature and stuff right. Like that. So argon, also a noble gas, does stick around. We have a larger amount of it because it will dissolve in seawater. And right. So there is some argon in the seawater, therefore there's more in the atmosphere and less of it needs to flit off into space.
It's a heavier gas.
It is also heavier than air. Just a little bit, just a little bit. So if you want to collect and isolate a large amount of neon nowadays to put into your, you know, advertising sign and whatever, you're going to use the same process nowadays as you would have back in its initial discovery in 1898 by Sir William Ramsey and Morris Travers. Mm-hmm. You're going to liquefy the air and then selectively boil off the different components and collect them separately. Right. So how do you liquefy air in the first place? You actually go through the same process that we do in modern refrigeration. This was called the Hampson-Lind refrigeration cycle.
Oh, yes, the Hampson-Lind.
In the Hampson-Lind refrigeration cycle, it's actually the same sort of cycle we do nowadays if you're running the refrigeration cycle on a refrigerator or on the compressor outside for your air conditioner. You are exerting a whole bunch of pressure to compress a gas down until it becomes a liquid. And then, I mean, when any gas becomes a liquid, it's going to expel a bunch of heat. So we're going to pass that warm liquid, compressed liquid, through a sort of heat sink or something like that so we can, you know, get rid of that heat. And so then that compressed liquid can be collected in a vessel, and then you just repeat the process over and over again, compressing more gas until it becomes liquid, collecting it, compressing, collecting, compressing, collecting, until you have enough. What Sir William Ramsay and Morris Travers did is they took a large sample of that compressed liquefied air, and they said, well, this is a mixture of substances. So they just slowly raised the temperature on it and allowed it to boil at very cold temperatures, you know, a little warmer temperatures. And of course, this is all very cold to begin with because liquid air only exists at very cold temperatures and high pressures.
And so the different gases are coming off based upon their boiling points. The ones with the lowest boiling points, which are the lightest gases, are going to come off first, and then...
Yes, and so they should boil off in order of their mass.
So you'd get helium, and then you get neon, and then you get argon.
And so then they were able to, I mean, this is the same method that William Ramsay used to identify what practically all of the noble gases. So yeah, argon first, and then neon, and then krypton, and then xenon, and then helium. Well, helium we already knew about because it was in the sun, but this was the first time we had found it terrestrially. And then later on, radon was discovered, but not by Sir William Ramsay. That was by someone else. And that's really the most interesting thing we can say about neon is its discovery. It's not a very reactive gas at all. In fact, it is the least reactive element on the periodic table.
I think it's more interesting that it fluoresces than the discovery stuff.
You just like the light. You just think it's pretty.
I just stare at the pretty lights.
You just think it's pretty. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't do anything. I don't know. It sounds like neon has big himbo energy, doesn't it? It's just pretty. It doesn't do much.
Pretty doesn't do much, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Doesn't form any compounds. Even helium will form compounds.
So you don't have anything else to tell us about neon? This is...
No, it's a boring element. It's just pretty.
It's a boring element. And so you're going to give it a rating?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to give it a rating of 1 star.
A 1 star.
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm going to give it a slightly higher rating because I think you're underrating the value of not doing any harm. We have just dealt with a savage beast, the element fluorine, which... killed a bunch of people while it was being discovered. William Ramsay made it through the discovery of neon quite well and never tried to kill him. I think primum non nocere, first do no harm. Neon follows that dictum, and I'm going to give it a slightly higher rating. I think it really deserves a 2, so I'm going to give it a 3 so that when we average it, it'll be a 2.
That's very...
strategic?
I would say conniving of you. Yeah, really.
All right. So 3 + 1 divided by 2
is an average of 2. 2 stars for neon.
This is the benefit of always rating second. All right. Next up, we'll have
sodium.
Ooh, we're starting the third row.
That's very right. Exciting. Row 3.
Yeah, sodium. Excellent. I can't wait to find out what happens when you chunk a big block of sodium into the pond. We'll have to wait, though, until next time on Yakety Science.
Eirenikos prosphilos eleluth.
Up next, we have our new sound science puzzler. In this segment, I will challenge you to identify a science-related sound. It could be the sounds made by an animal, physical phenomenon, or it could be something that is associated with science in some other way. And that is the case with today's sound science puzzler. Here is your new puzzler.
Since if you don't worry about it now, it's too late later on. And so in this issue, as in so many other issues, we are passing on extremely grave problems for our children when the time to solve the problems, if they can be solved at all, is now.
So that is our new sound science puzzle. Let's have it one more time.
Since if you don't worry about it now, it's too late later on. And so in this issue, as in so many other issues, we are passing on extremely grave problems for our children when the time to solve the problems, if they can be solved at all, is now.
All right, so that's our sound science puzzler. I'm not going to tell you who it is. I'm not going to tell you what they're talking about. You need to tell me. So those are the questions. Who was speaking, which may be the easier part of it? And then what was he talking about, which may be the slightly... more difficult part of it. It was in 1985 in testimony before Congress that the statement was made. So tell me what this is all in reference to, what's happening. So if you think you know the answers to those questions, send your answers to yakityscience@gmail.com. Be sure to include your name email address, contact number, social security number, date of birth, and your mother's maiden name. All of those would be much appreciated. We'll reveal the answer on the next episode of Yakety Science. Next up, we have Yakety Science Ruins the Movies. In this segment, we will take on a Hollywood blockbuster and pedantically explain how they got the science so incredibly wrong. Yes, we are those know-it-all people that you never want to take to the movies. We just can't enjoy ourselves, and we want to share that lack of joy with you. To get us started today, listen to the following.
Look at this trove, treasures untold. How many wonders can one cavern hold? Looking around here, you think, sure, she's got everything. I've got gadgets and gizmos aplenty. I've got who's its and what's its galore. You want thingamabobs? I got 20. But who cares? No big deal. I want more.
So that was, of course, Disney's The Little Mermaid.
Are we really talking about an animated children's thing?
We definitely are. No film is more widely beloved than this marine biology classic. I will admit to being forced to watch this film dozens of times when my kids were much younger. It does wear a bit thin after a while, but there is no doubting the importance of this tale of a young mermaid and her amphibious quest to live among the tetrapods, especially the oh-so-charming Eric. It has enchanted and educated generations. Be honest, who has taught you more about life under the sea? Jacques Cousteau or Walt Disney and Ariel?
I mean, fair. All right, fair.
Undoubtedly, it is Walt Disney and Ariel. But what I ask you is the quality of that education. I have no quibble with the depiction of mer people and their kingdom. As far as I'm aware, that is spot on. Similarly, I cannot fault the portrayal of the evil Ursula and her eels or the musical abilities of Sebastian the Crab. But there is a big blue and yellow striped elephant in the room, smack in the middle of King Triton's palace, that must be addressed. That's right, it's the animated abomination known to the world as Flounder.
Flounder, the fish companion.
The fish companion.
He's cute.
Yeah,
he's silly.
He's cute. But the name makes no sense. This is what has driven me crazy every time I have watched it. I just cannot get past this. They have depicted some sort of generic coral reef fish, a clownfish with different colors, or an angelfish, or bluegill sunfish. It looks a little like that. And they've called it Flounder, one of the most distinctive and grotesque of all the fishes. A flounder is a bottom dweller. It is a flatfish. It is known, at least by those who have not been led astray by the lies of Walt Disney, for the fact that both of its eyes are on the same side of its head. So you have right-sided flatfish and you have left-sided flatfish. If both eyes are on the right side or both eyes are on the left side, I ask you, Matt, to look at this picture and compare here the actual flounder with the flounder from the animated film. And tell the listeners what you're seeing here.
You know, I think that I got a better education on what a flounder looked like through Animal Crossing.
Did you?
When you catch fish in Animal Crossing, the flounder does look like that.
It does look like that, yes. So can you imagine the confusion that would be experienced by the viewing public if Timon and Pumbaa had been named Zebra and Giraffe? I mean, people would just be, what are they talking about? What are we seeing here? I mean, people would be rioting in the theaters if they had done that. But people accept this when they call this cuddly little looking fish flounder because they have no idea what a flounder is. It just speaks to a profound lack of knowledge about what's under the sea. I feel like I'm channeling Jacques Cousteau. The sea is most of the planet. It is most of life. And yet for most of us, it is a sea of ignorance. And it leads to such absurdities as this character, Flounder, from The Little Mermaid. And what did Walt Disney do? What did the Disney Corporation do when they had the opportunity?
They made a live action
version, right? In the live action film, to correct this gross error, They did the exact same thing over again.
Oh, he's just cute. I haven't seen it, so I don't know.
They just need to pick a different name. Call him Buddy. They could have called him Buddy. Or Jar Jar Binks or something. He is the useless sidekick.
And I mean, Sebastian isn't named, like, after another animal.
No, he's not.
Flounder named after another animal?
Another animal that it does not resemble.
Right. Yeah.
All right. So that's it. I'm not going to delve any farther into the sins of Walt Disney, but I just had to get that off my chest.
I appreciate your nerd rage in this moment. Yes.
All right. Well, next time we will destroy another classic for you, no doubt. Now, none of you will be able to watch The Little Mermaid without getting angry about Flounder, the adorable little Flounder. You'll be filled with hatred and rage towards the adorable little Flounder. And next time we will ruin a completely different movie for you.
See, that is the point of ruining the movies. That you watch them through new eyes.
Yes.
Eyes that hate.
Eyes of hate.
Eyes of disappointment.
All right. That's it. Well, that's it for the 10th episode of Yakety Science. We're in double digits, Matt. Did you ever think you'd see the day?
And we're not going to stop either.
Not going to stop. Not unless we are bribed a significant amount of money.
Oh, sure. We can be bought.
We can
be shut
up. And yeah, it would have to be more than double digits. We'd have to be, I don't know, high three figures, I think, in order for us to stop. But assuming that doesn't happen, we are going to continue. So as always, we leave you with a wise, wise quote from a science-y person of note. This particular quote came to me as I was reflecting upon the loss of funding for messenger RNA vaccines. Just yesterday, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announced the cancellation of this really important program that is helping to develop messenger RNA vaccines that would be a protection against new coronaviruses, new flu viruses. Anyway, it put me in mind of the following quote. I have a foreboding of an America in my children's or grandchildren's time when awesome technological powers are in the hands of a very few and no one representing the public interest can even grasp the issues, when the people have lost the ability to set their own agendas or knowledgeably question those in authority, when clutching our crystals and nervously consulting our horoscopes, our critical faculties in decline, unable to distinguish between what feels good and what's true, we slide, almost without noticing, back into superstition and darkness. That is, of course, Carl Sagan. And with those prophetic and humbling words, we leave you, dear listeners, until the next episode of Yakety Science. Thanks for joining us.
Take care now.
Yakety Science is produced, written, and edited by Matt Smith and Brian Cross. Production help provided by Scott Gregory. Theme music by Lobo Loco. Yakety Science is recorded at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa and at the Center for Creativity at Tulsa Community College. If you'd like to yak back at us, our email is yaketyscience@gmail.com. We love to hear from you. I have this image of kind of like a Club Med resort and the jacuzzi pool and like a really creepy guy getting into the pool and then the females just kind of all doing the dead man's floats, just kind of until he, and the guy, instead of going for help, was like, oh, she's going to wake up, just kind of nudging her. Babe.